Good evening, everybody, and welcome. It is 11 p.m. Eastern Time, Wednesday, it's the 19th, 2020, and thanks for joining us for the 91st episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show and questions in the live chat room at 914-338-0314 or the chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. This show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship nor medical or legal representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro, and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music that will be played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. As always, thank you very much, and if you would please let us know the name of the song and the artist, and it's relevant to tonight's topic.
Well, as is so often the case. This is yet another example of my shameless self-promotion.
Fair enough.
So this is one of my own tunes called A Good Idea at the Time. And oh. How that's related, right, and how that's related to the topic is that the topic we're going to discuss, it actually starts out as a very good idea at the time as a coping tool, because it was one of the few constructive coping tools that was available to the individual at that point. But after a few years go by, not so much. So that was my kind of funky logic in choosing this for tonight's show.
All right. Yes. No, I can totally see how you would say that. So, yes, that's perfect. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Dr. Mathis mentions, tonight's episode is entitled Dissociative Identity Disorder, which we will discuss in a moment. So before we begin our topic discussion, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
So tonight I'm going to pay homage to Peter Allen Greenbaum. And people are probably shaking their head going, who the heck is that? Yeah. Better known to our public as Peter Green.
Ah,
Who recently passed a few weeks ago. Who most of you know, if you know anything about blues rock, was a very well-heeled blues rock guitar player whose style and tone are still emulated to this day. He was inducted in 1998 in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame along with Fleetwood Mac, because he was the co-founder of Fleetwood Mac. And while he was with the band, because Fleetwood Mac started out really as a blues rock band and a bluesy band, not a kind of a poppy rock band that they became in later years. And that's not a slam, that's a description of their music. So when Peter Green was with them, He wrote such songs as Man of the World, which was a single for them, an early single for them. Also was the author of The Green Man Alishi with the two-pronged crown that Judas Priest covered later.
I'm very fond of that.
That's a Fleetwood Mac song. That's Peter Green Fleetwood Mac song, actually.
What? Okay. Rain is blown up now.
Uh-huh. And he also did a song called Albatross, which I think, if I remember correctly, was an instrumental, but I could be mistaken. I'm having a hard time remembering that. But he's also the author of Oh Well, which they still perform to this day, and a song that everybody knows that they attribute to the wrong artist, Black Magic Woman, made famous by Santana. But that's a Peter Green song with when he was with Fleetwood Mac.
Oh.
So, yeah. So people hear that and they go, oh, Santana. Well, yeah, Santana made it famous. But do you know who wrote it and originally did it? And most people go, huh? So he was considered to be part of the second great epoch of British blues movement. And actually, even Americans had commented on this. B.B. King at one point commented that he had one of the sweetest tones he'd ever heard, and the only other blues guitar player that could, quote-unquote, give me the cold sweats. But he's been praised by everybody from B.B. King to Eric Clapton to just a shoot ton of people. So originally started out playing bass guitar, and he was taught first chords by his brother. And by the age of 15, he was playing professionally in bands. He was very much influenced by The Shadows, which, of course, Hank Martin was the big guitar player, hero from there. And so he was a big Hank Martin guy and really got influenced by some of the style that he did. And so he eventually ends up with Mick Fleetwood, who's a drummer, most of you know, is a drummer and the other co-founder of Fleetwood Mac. So prior to that, most people know that John Mayall and his Blues Breakers, which featured Eric Clapton, which is where Eric got his nickname Slowhand from John Mayall, and where he Yeah, right. John Mayall gave him the nickname Slow Hand, obviously as a joke. And Clapton's also the guy that made one of the Marshall amplifiers famous to the point where it's now called the Marshall Bluesbreaker, even though it actually has a number on it, you know, a model number. I don't even know what the model number is, to be honest with you, which is a little frightening. But because it's so identified with the Bluesbreakers, it's considered the Bluesbreakers Marshall. And it's really awesome. And Clapton's the one that took it into the studio and was cranking it up, and the engineers were freaking out. That was the height of, you know, Clapton is God. And the engineer kept trying to get him to turn it down. And Mayall just goes over to the engineer. He goes, give God what he wants, which I think is great. Anyway, Green filled in for Clapton on a couple of occasions where he was missing. And then he did, I think, four gigs with them. And then Clapton left the Bluesbreakers to go with Cream. And when he did, that's when Green stepped in, became a full member of the Bluesbreakers, I think in mid-66, don't quote me on that. And after he made some debut records with the Bluesbreakers and some stuff, he decided to leave and form his own blues-based band, which, of course, became Fleetwood Mac. So he and Mick Fleetwood started the band, eventually recruited John McVie on bass, who was playing for another band at the time, so they had a temporary bass player. I think his name was Bob Brunning. And he played with them for a while, toured with them for a while, and then John McVie left and came with them. And then, you know, the rest is sort of history. And then Green played with them for a long time, but the problem was, for several years, but the problem was that on some of their tours in 1970, he started having a large fascination with LSD and started kind of going down a path he never really recovered from. And he started growing a beard and, you know, donning very weird kind of prophet-esque robes and a crucifix and, you know, all kinds of, started doing very bizarre behaviors. And, you know, so that was sort of the start of his downfall. And eventually left Fleetwood Mac and to do a variety of other bands, mostly where he was, you know, the leader of the band, so to speak. Unfortunately, because of his LSD use, or maybe speeded up because of the LSD use, he had a psychotic break and was diagnosed with schizophrenia, I think in the mid-70s, and ended up getting ECT, which back in the day was what they did. And, you know, the rest is sort of like downhill from there. And, of course, he made some albums in the meantime from there. And he would come out occasionally and then kind of go back and have, you know, an episode and kind of disappear from the music scene. Would come back and disappear and come back. And there were rumors that they were going to do a Fleetwood Mac kind of reunion dilly where they were going to have him play with them. And, you know, but he couldn't stay clean, you know, and sane, for lack of a better term, long enough to do anything really significant. And, you know, while he made probably five or six records apart from Fleetwood Mac, all of which were, you know, had really great tone and great riffs, which influenced a shoot ton of people after him, including Gary Moore, Andy Powell, who's the guitar player for Wishbone Ash, Radiohead's Colin Greenwood, Joe Perry of Aerosmith, and all these people cite him as a huge talent. I mean, Jimmy Page was, you know, all kinds of accolades on him and talked about it. In fact, one of the luthiers, Taya, that I mentioned in a much earlier show, has one of the tones on his guitars patented after the Peter Green sound. So, I mean, this guy has been hugely influential. Started out on, a Harmony Meteor, and eventually, which is just a cheapy hollow body guitar, and eventually ended up with Les Paul, which has sort of got the, has this magical mojo on it, and eventually ends up in the hands of Kirk Hammett of Metallica, who paid a pretty penny for it. Yeah. So, I mean, this guy has been a huge influence on just a whole lot of people, and passed away a couple of weeks ago. I think he was 73. And had been married, I think, in 78 and divorced shortly after there. Had a daughter from that marriage. And I think lived on Canby Island, if I'm not mistaken, after the Fleetwood Mac stuff. But, I mean, he was in and out. You know, ended up moving in with his brother and his brother's wife and their, and his mom. And, you know, because, I mean, he was just, he would have these bouts of, you know, schizophrenia and drug taking, and obviously those two things don't mix really well. It's unfortunate that I find that most psychological disordered folks tend to gravitate towards the very drug they have the least business doing, like schizophrenics doing hallucinogens and ADHD people doing hallucinogens, pot, but it's a crappy hallucinogen, but it's their drug of choice, and it's the last drug they ought to be doing. And depressed people doing alcohol. I'm like, huh? If you're going to do that shit, do cocaine. It's going to help the depression. You know, and I joke about it. But, I mean, it's just really sad.
Dr. Bathurst, I'm serious. Don't go out and do coke and blame him for it now. You know better.
Yeah. So it's just really sad, but, you know, he is, while he wasn't as successful as an artist as he could have been because of his mental illness and his substance abuse, he had a his playing style and tone have had a profound impact on the music business, even to this day. People rave and rant about him. So I wanted to put a shout out to him because a lot of folks don't, you know, have never even heard of him. And don't know that he's the author of Black Magic Woman or Green Man Alishi or, you know, Oh Well or any of the stuff that people go, oh, I know that song. Yeah, Peter Green. So I wanted to give a shout out to him and condolences to his relatives.
Okay. Well, that's definitely one of those, you know, had no idea I actually knew who that was, you know, as a lot of these trivia stories end up, which is the beauty of them. So thank you for that.
Sure.
Always learning something fun and interesting, and that's the point. So
yes,
again,
ma'am.
We will
Absolutely.
Take calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening up until midnight. So feel free to give us a call. And again, the number is 914-338-0314. All righty. So tonight's topic is Dissociative Identity Disorder, or DID. We touched on some aspects of dissociative identity disorder way back at episodes 24 and 25, which was Pathology Chic back in July 2017. And that episode was about how various mental illnesses are portrayed in media and entertainment. But tonight is our first episode specifically dedicated to this condition by request of one of our followers. So dissociative identity disorder is more commonly known by your average laypeople by its outdated names, which are multiple personality disorder or split personalities. This is a condition that is less common than many people often deal with, but it's still important to understand because it's far more common than most people believe. When one realizes DID's suspected likely causes are thought to be rooted in childhood trauma and abuse, and that it was often dismissed or derisively painted as a faked condition until the last few decades, one can certainly see the unfortunate potential for overlooking, underestimating, or misdiagnosing sufferers. Many of us only know about this pathology through movies and media, so we will also spend a little bit of time tonight addressing matters of misinformation. So tonight we will discuss the history of dissociative identity disorder, our current understanding of dissociative identity disorder, myths and misconceptions about dissociative identity disorder, and suggestions for coping and mitigating symptoms. And before we get started, I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's anything you want to bring up before we get going.
I'm good.
All righty. So let's go ahead and dive in. First, let's talk about, an overview of some of the basics that have led up to our current understanding of this particular pathology. So this is the history segment. Early history. The first recognized case of DID was thought to be described by Paracelsus in 1646. And Paracelsus was originally Theophrastus von Hohenheim. He was a Swiss physician, alchemist, lay theologian, and philosopher of the German Renaissance. In the 19th century, De Dubremont, or double consciousness, the historical precursor to DID, was frequently described as a state of sleepwalking, with scholars hypothesizing that the patients were switching between a normal consciousness and a somnambulistic state. Also in the 19th century, there were a number of reported cases of multiple personalities, which R.W. Ryber, in his 2002 paper, The Duality of the Brain and the Multiplicity of Minds, Can You Have It Both Ways?, which was posted in the journal History of Psychiatry. He estimated that there were close to 100 reported cases like this. Epilepsy was seen as a factor in some cases, and discussion of this possible connection continues into the present era. By the late 19th century, there was a general acceptance that emotionally traumatic experiences could cause long-term disorders, which might display a variety of symptoms. I apologize in advance. I have a bit of a cough tonight, which I am trying to keep from inflicting on you guys when possible. So these conversion disorders were found to occur in even the most resilient individuals, but with profound effect in someone with emotional instability. For example, like Louis Vivet, was born in 1863. My source was unclear when he's passed. He was noted because he suffered a traumatic experience as a 17-year-old when he encountered a viper, and no, not the Dodge car. Vivet was a subject of countless medical papers and became the most studied case of disassociation during the 19th century. Between 1880 and 1920, so the turn of the next century, various international medical conferences devoted time to sessions on dissociation. It was in this climate that Jean-Martin Charcot introduced his ideas of the impact of nervous shocks as a cause for a variety of neurological conditions. One of Charcot's students, Pierre Janet, took these ideas and went on to develop his own theories of dissociation. One of the first individuals diagnosed with multiple personalities to be scientifically studied was Clara Norton Fowler under the pseudonym Christine Beauchamp. American neurologist Morton Prince studied Fowler between 1898 and 1904, describing her case study in his 1906 monograph, Dissociation of a Personality. Now we come to the 20th century. In the early 20th century, interest in dissociation and multiple personalities waned for several reasons. After Charcot's death in 1893, many of his so-called hysterical patients were exposed as frauds, and Janet's association with Charcot tarnished his theories of dissociation. Sigmund Freud recanted his earlier emphasis on dissociation and childhood trauma. Next, in 1908, Eugen Bleuler introduced the term schizophrenia to represent a revised disease concept for Emil Kraepelin's dementia praecox. Whereas Kraepelin natural disease entity was anchored in the metaphor of progressive deterioration and mental weakness and defect, Bleuler offered a reinterpretation based on dissociation or splitting, what he called spaltung, S-P-A-L-T-U-N-G, and widely broadened the inclusion criteria for the diagnosis. Next, a review of the Index Medicus from 1903 through 1978 showed a dramatic decline in the number of reports of multiple personality after the diagnosis of schizophrenia became popular, especially in the United States. Pardon me just a moment. Sorry, having a little cough, having a little drink to get rid of it. Okay, The rise of the broad diagnostic category of dementia praecox has also been posited in the disappearance of, quote, hysteria, the usual diagnostic designation for cases of multiple personalities, by 1910. A number of factors helped create a large climate of skepticism and disbelief. Paralleling the increased suspicion of DID was the decline of interest in dissociation as a laboratory and clinical phenomenon. Starting in about 1927, there was a large increase in the number of reported cases of schizophrenia, which was matched by an equally large decrease in the number of multiple personality reports. With the rise of a uniquely American reframing of dementia praecox / schizophrenia as a functioning disorder or, quote, reaction to psychobiological stressors, a theory first put forth by Adolf Mayer in 1906. Many trauma-induced conditions associated with dissociation, including shell shock or war neuroses during World War I, were subsumed under these diagnoses. It was argued up into the 1980s, that DID patients were often misdiagnosed as suffering from schizophrenia. In 1957, with the publication of the best-selling book, The Three Phases of Eve, by psychiatrists Corbett H. Thigpen and Hervey M. Cleckley, based on a case study of their patient Chris Costner Sizemore, and the subsequent popular movie of the same name, the American public's interest in multiple personality was revived. More cases of dissociative identity disorder were diagnosed in the following years. The cause of the sudden increase of cases is indefinite, but it may be attributed to the increased awareness, which revealed previously undiagnosed cases, or new cases may have been induced by the influence of the media on the behavior of individuals and the judgment of therapists. During the 1970s, an initially small number of clinicians campaigned to have it considered a legitimate diagnosis. By the way, fun trivia fact, when I was in high school in Fairfax County, Virginia, I'm not going to identify the high school, there was some connection, and it's been a very long time because I am practically Precambrian and dinosaurs brought us to school. There was some connection to our high school, and I believe that it was that one of the children of Chris Sizemore had attended our school. And so therefore, every so often, about once a year or so for several years, including when I was there, Chris would come and give a talk about, at that time, what she referred to as multiple personality disorder. So I actually had a chance to see her from the back of a classroom and hear her talk. But of course, that was 50 bazillion years ago. And you know, a lot has changed since then. In fact, I think Chris has passed away in the meantime. But anyway, I just thought that was a little fun fact. I actually got to see her lecture in high school, and we had that every year for a long time. Okay, in 1974, the highly influential book Sybil was published and later made into a miniseries in 76 and again in 2007. In fact, I want to say in 76, was it Sally Field that played her? I might be wrong about that. I can't remember.
I've never actually seen it.
I taped it on VHS off a cable, and it's been so damn long since I've seen it that I can't remember anymore. But I can't go look at the cover of the tape because it's manual, so I don't have a proper cover. I digress. So describing what Robert Reber called the third most famous of all multiple personality cases, it presented a detailed discussion of the problems of treatment of, quote, Sybil Isabel Dorset, which was a pseudonym for Shirley Ardell Mason. Excuse me. Though the book and subsequent films helped popularize the diagnosis and trigger an epidemic of the diagnosis, and we talked about this on the show, the power of suggestion in the media, you write an article, you do a movie, and suddenly everyone has it because it's the cool thing to have now, and that's unfortunately kind of a thing, at least with Americans. Later analysis of the case suggested different interpretations, ranging from Mason's problems having been caused by the therapeutic methods used by her psychiatrist, Cornelia Wilbur, or an inadvertent hoax due in part to the lucrative publishing rights, though this conclusion has itself been challenged. I don't know if they ever resolved it. I couldn't find that out. Dr. David Spiegel, who was a Stanford psychiatrist whose father treated Mason on occasion, said that his father described Mason as, quote, a brilliant hysteric. He felt that Dr. Wilbur tended to pressure her to exaggerate on the dissociation she already had. As media attention on DID increased, so too did the controversy surrounding the diagnosis. And lastly, in the 20th century, in a 1986 book chapter, later reprinted in another volume, philosopher of science Ian Hacking focused on multiple personality disorder as an example of, quote, making up people through the untoward effects on individuals of the, quote, dynamic nominalism in medicine and psychiatry. With the invention of new terms, entire new categories of natural kinds of people are assumed to be created, and those thus diagnosed respond by recreating their identity in light of the new cultural, medical, scientific, political, and moral expectations. Hacking argued that the process of making up people is historically contingent, hence it is not surprised to find the rise, fall, and resurrection of such categories over time. Hacking revisited his concept of making up people in an article published in the London Review of Books in August 2006. All right, and lastly, in the 21st century, a 2006 study comparing scholarly research and publications on DID and dissociative amnesia to other mental health conditions such as anorexia nervosa, alcohol abuse, and schizophrenia from 1984 to 2003. The results were found to be unusually distributed, with a very low level of publications in the 1980s, followed by a significant rise that peaked in the mid-90s, and subsequently rapidly declined in the decade following. Compared to 25 other diagnoses, the mid-90s bubble of publications regarding DID was unique. In the opinion of the authors of the review, the publication results suggested a period of, quote, fashion that waned, and that the two diagnoses did not command widespread scientific acceptance, end quote. Pardon me a moment. Okay, I'm really over the coughing thing. I apologize. Next in history, the history of this pathology in the DSM specifically. So the DSM-2 used the term hysterical neurosis dissociative type. It described the possible occurrence of alterations in the patient's state of consciousness or identity and included the symptoms of, quote, amnesia, somnambulism, fugue, and multiple personality, end quote. The DSM-3 grouped the diagnosis with the other four major dissociative disorders using the term, quote, multiple personality disorder. The DSM-4 made more changes to DID than any other dissociative disorder and renamed it DID. Incidentally, the name change was for two main reasons. First, the change emphasizes the main problem is not a multitude of personalities, but rather a lack of a single unified identity, and an emphasis on, quote, the identities as centers of information processing. Secondly, the term personality is used to refer to characteristic patterns of thoughts, feelings, moods, and behaviors of the whole individual. While for a patient with DID, the switches between identity and behavior patterns is the personality. It is for this reason the DSM-4-TR referred to distinct identities or personality states instead of personalities. The diagnostic criteria also changed to indicate that while the patient may name and personalize alters, they lack independent objective existence. The changes also included the addition of amnesia as a symptom, which was not included in DSM-3R, because despite being a core symptom of the condition, patients may experience amnesia for the amnesia and fail to report it. Excuse me. Amnesia was replaced when it became clear that the risk of false negative diagnoses was low, because amnesia was central to DID. The The ICD-10 places the diagnosis in the category of dissociative disorders within the subcategory of other dissociative, quote, conversion disorders, but continues to list the condition as multiple personality disorder. With the publication of the DSM-3, which omitted the terms hysteria and neurosis, and thus the former categories for dissociative disorders, dissociative diagnoses became, quote, orphans within their own categories, with dissociative identity disorder appearing as, quote, multiple personality disorder. In the opinion of McGill University psychiatrist Joel Paris, this inadvertently legitimized them by forcing textbooks which mimicked the structure of the DSM to include a separate chapter on them and resulted in an increase of diagnosis of dissociative conditions. Once a rarely occurring spontaneous phenomenon, research in 1944 showed only 76 cases. And I don't know if that's internationally or if that's just in the U.S. They didn't say. Became an artifact of bad or naive psychotherapy, as patients capable of dissociating were accidentally encouraged to express their symptoms by overly fascinated therapists. Messy, messy stuff. No wonder people can't figure it out. Okay, next part. The DSM-4 TR criteria for DID has been criticized for failing to capture the clinical complexity of DID, lacking usefulness in diagnosing individuals with DID. For instance, by focusing on the two least frequent and most subtle symptoms of DID, producing a high rate of false negatives and an excessive number of DDNOS diagnoses, for excluding possession, seen as a cross-cultural form of DID, and for including only two core symptoms of DID, being amnesia and self-alteration, while failing to discuss hallucinations, trance-like states, somatoform depersonalization, and derealization symptoms. Arguments have been made for allowing diagnosis through the presence of some, but not all, of the characteristics of DID, rather than the current exclusive focus on the two least common and noticeable features. Next, the DSM-5 updated the definition of DID in 2013, summarizing the changes as several changes to the criteria for dissociative identity disorder have been made in DSM-5. First, criterion A has been expanded to include certain possession form phenomena and functional neurological symptoms to account for more diverse presentations of this disorder. Second, criteria A now specifies that transitions in identity may be observable by others or self-reported. Third, according to criterion B, individuals with dissociative identity disorder may have recurring gaps in recall for everyday events, not just for traumatic experiences. Other text modifications clarify the nature and course of identity disruption, end quote. Between 1968 and 1980, the term that was used for dissociative identity disorder was hysterical neuroses dissociative type. The APA wrote in the second edition of the DSM, quote, in the dissociative type, alterations may occur in the patient's state of consciousness or in his identity to produce such symptoms as amnesia, somnambulism, fugue, and multiple personality, end quote. This was mentioned earlier. The number of cases sharply increased in the 1970s and throughout the 80s, and the first scholarly monographs on the topic appeared in 86. Interpersonality amnesia was removed as a diagnostic feature from the DSM-3 in 87, which may have contributed to the increasing frequency of the diagnosis. There were 200 reported cases of DID as of 1980 and 20,000 from 80 to 1990. Joan Acacella reports that 40,000 cases were diagnosed from 85 to 95. Scientific publications regarding DID peaked in the mid-1990s, then rapidly declined. There were several contributing factors to the rapid decline of reports of multiple personality disorder, dissociative identity disorder. One was a discontinuation in December 97 of Disassociation, Progress, and the Dissociative Disorders, the Journal of the International Society for the Study of Multiple Personality and Dissociation. The society and its journal were perceived as uncritical sources of legitimacy for the extraordinary claims of the existence of intergenerational satanic cults responsible for a hidden holocaust of satanic ritual abuse that was linked to the rise of MPD reports. In an effort to distance itself from the increasing skepticism regarding the clinical validity of MPD, the organization dropped multiple personality from its official name in 93, and then in 97 changed its name again to the International Society for the Study of Trauma and Dissociation. That's a lot. That's a mouthful. Oh, my God. Okay. In 94, the fourth edition of the DSM replaced the criteria again and changed the name of the condition from multiple personality disorder to the currently accepted dissociative identity disorder to emphasize the importance of changes to consciousness and identity rather than personality. The inclusion of interpersonality amnesia helped to distinguish DID from dissociative disorder not otherwise specified, which is usually called DDNOS, but the condition retains an inherent subjectivity due to difficulty in defining terms such as personality, identity, ego state, and even amnesia. The ICD-10 classified DID as a dissociative conversion disorder and used the name multiple personality disorder with the classification number of F4481, for those of you keeping track. In the ICD-11, the WHO have classified DID under the name dissociative identity disorder, coded as 6B64, and in most cases formally diagnosed as DDNOS are classified as partial dissociative identity disorder, coded as 6B65. Big mouthful of history for you guys, but that's how we got to where we are now, which we'll cover in a moment, but I'm going to stop and talk to Dr. Mathis and see if he would like to add anything.
Let's jump into where we are now.
Okay. All right, so let's jump into our current understanding of dissociative identity disorder. First part, the naming. As you can already see, there's been a lot of business about naming this. So this first snip, the source is Psychology Today online. DID was called multiple personality disorder up until 94 when the name was changed to reflect a better understanding of the condition, namely that it is characterized by fragmentation or splintering of identity rather than by a proliferation or growth of separate personalities. Second comment, and this is notes that I made from comments that Dr. Mathis made to me earlier today. Also, the previous name often confused both patients and clinicians because the phrasing seemed to imply that the disorders should be grouped into either cluster A, B, or C disorders, into which it did not fit. There are currently 10 main types of recognized personality disorders in the DSM-5, which are grouped into three clusters by type. A is the odd or eccentric. B is dramatic or erratic. We talk about cluster B a lot on this show. Or C, fearful and anxious. Yeah. The new wording alleviates this type of confusion. The next part is something that I have had a struggle with because I write this down correctly, but I mislearned how to pronounce it when I first heard it. So this name is often mispronounced. Dissociative identity disorder. Don't do like me and do that.
You are certainly not in the minority, let me tell you.
Yes, and I'm going to learn better, and I encourage our listeners to learn better. So dissociative, no A in the middle of that. Dissociate is a word with Latin roots, and that means to sever or separate. Dissociative personality disorder is often a naming mistake people make when conflating it with its former name, multiple personality disorder. So remember, it's dissociative identity disorder. And also, DID is but one of several dissociative disorders, no identity in that phrase. It is not the only pathology of its kind, and we'll get to that in a little bit too. Definition. According to the DSM-5, the following criteria must be met for an individual to be diagnosed with dissociative identity disorder. First, the individual experiences two or more distinct identities or personality states, each with its own enduring pattern of perceiving, relating to, and thinking about the environment and self. Some cultures describe this as an experience of possession. It isn't necessarily, but it's kind of complicated to explain the differences. The disruption in identity involves a change in sense of self, sense of agency, and changes in behavior, consciousness, memory, perception, cognition, and even motor function. There are incidences of people who have this who switch handedness, or one alter is disabled, another one is not, all kinds of things like that. Frequent gaps are found in the individual's memories of personal history, including people, places, and events, for both the distant and recent past. These recurring gaps are not consistent with ordinary forgetting. Sorry. The symptoms cause clinically significant distress or impairment in social, occupational, or other important areas of functioning. All right, this next part of explaining the definition is from clevelandclinic.org. DID is one of a group of conditions called dissociative disorders. Dissociative disorders are mental illnesses that involve disruptions or breakdowns of memory, consciousness, or awareness, identity, and or perception. Instances of true DID are very rare. When they occur, they can occur at any age, and females are more likely than males to get DID. Next definition is from mayoclinic.org, and they say there are three major dissociative disorders defined in the DSM-5, published by the APA. And they are dissociative amnesia. The main symptom is memory loss that's more severe than ordinary forgetfulness. Sorry. And that cannot be explained by a medical condition. Pardon me just a moment. Yeah, holding that in was getting to be a drama. The second, what we're talking about tonight, dissociative identity disorder, formerly known as multiple personality disorder. This disorder is characterized by, quote, switching to alternate identities. And the last is depersonalization/derealization disorder. This involves an ongoing or episodic sense of detachment or being outside yourself, observing your actions, feelings, thoughts, and self from a distance as though watching a movie, depersonalization. And there is an element of this in DID as well, but it's a little bit different. Okay, next let's talk about symptoms. This first bit, the source is Psychology Today Online. Particular identities may emerge in specific circumstances. Transitions from one identity to another are often triggered by psychosocial stress. In the possession form of dissociative identity disorder, alternate identities are visibly obvious to people around the individual. In non-possession form cases, most individuals do not overtly display their change in identity for long periods of time. People with DID may describe feeling that they may have suddenly become depersonalized observers of their own speech and actions. They might report hearing voices, a child's voice, or the voice of a spiritual power. And in some cases, the voices accompany multiple streams of thought that the individual has no control over. The individual might also experience sudden impulses or strong emotions that they don't feel control or a sense of ownership over. People may also report that their bodies suddenly feel different, like that of a small child or someone huge and muscular, or that they experience a sudden change in attitudes or personal preferences before shifting back. Sometimes people with DID experience dissociative fugue in which they discover, for example, that they have traveled but have no recollection of the experience. They vary in their awareness of their amnesia, and it is common for people with DID to minimize their amnestic symptoms even when the lapses in memory are obvious and distressing to others. According to the DSM-5, more than 70% of people with DID have attempted suicide at least once, and self-injurious behavior is common among this population. Treatment is crucial to improving quality of life and preventing suicide attempts for those with DID. This is from clevelandclinic.org. What are the symptoms of DID? A person with DID has two or more different and distinct personalities, the person's usual, quote, core personality, and what are known as alternate personalities or alters. The person may experience amnesia when an alter takes control over the person's behavior. Each alter has distinct individual traits, a personal history, and a way of thinking about and relating to his or her surroundings. Actually, that reminds me of a question, Dr. Mathis, and I didn't write this in there because it just dawns on me now. Has there been much occurrence of people who have this where some of the alters don't have a gender or are gender fluid or anything else that has become more recognized?
They're always gendered. But
interesting.
A female can have a male alter and male or alter, several male alters and a couple of female alters. So, you know, a lot of people think, oh, how's this person's a female, identified female, and they're having a male alter. What's that about? Well, that's actually not uncommon.
Interesting. Okay. I am fascinated by the fact that there doesn't seem to be any occurrence of alters without a binary gender. So that's kind of interesting. I don't know what's up with that, but something to poke later, maybe. An alter may be of a different gender, as Dr. Mathis just mentioned. They'll have a different name or a distinct set of manners and preferences. Parenthetically, an alter may even have different allergies than the core person. That's interesting to me because allergies are a biological reaction. So I'm not sure how that works.
Well, think about it this way. If you change your brain firing pattern, your neuronal firing pattern, you're going to change brain chemistry, which means you're going to change chemistry of the body at some level if you do it enough.
Wow.
Uh-huh.
That has huge potential for all kinds of fun. I don't have notes for tonight, but maybe we'll come back to it.
Okay.
So the person with DID may or may not be aware of the other personality states and memories of the times when an alter is dominant. Stress or even a reminder of a trauma can trigger a switch of alters. In some cases, the person with DID may benefit from a particular alter. For example, a shy person may use a more aggressive alter to negotiate a contract. More often, DID creates a chaotic life and problems in personal and work relationships. For example, a woman with DID may repeatedly meet people who seem to know her but whom she does not recognize or remember ever meeting, where she may find items around the home that she does not remember buying. DID shares many psychological symptoms as those found in other mental disorders, including, but not limited to, amnesia, memory loss, or feeling of time distortion, anxiety, changing levels of functioning from highly affective to disturbed or disabled, depersonalization, feeling disconnected from one's own thoughts, feelings, and body, depression and or mood swings, derealization, feeling that the surrounding environment is foreign, odd, or unreal in some way, eating and sleeping disturbances, hallucinations, false perceptions or sensory experiences such as hearing voices, problems with functioning sexuality, self-injurious behavior such as cutting, severe headaches or pain in other parts of the body, substance abuse, and suicide risk. Remember, 70% of people with DID have made a suicide attempt. And next, we're going to talk about diagnosis. And I have a question for Dr. Mathis. What are some of the diagnostic tools for determining or differentiating whether common symptoms like these are pointing to DID specifically? What is the proverbial tipping point of symptoms?
Well, it's kind of a complicated issue. And I can certainly talk about it. What we may also want to do is finish the second half of this another time because we're sort of getting to the midnight hour.
Okay. So we can go ahead and talk about this. We may end up pausing at diagnosis and calling it an evening.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, okay. So, but I do want to answer your question. So
sure.
It's kind of complicated, but part of the answer is very amorphous in the sense that if you remember the judge in the Mapplethorpe case back in the 90s, when the judge ruled that it was art and not pornography, and then the reporters went up to the judge and says, "Hey, judge, how do you know? What do you use to distinguish between pornography and art?" And the judge's response was something like,
I don't know, but I'll know it when I see it. Yep.
Right? And that's kind of my response to you with the DID. Now, but what you also want to do is rule out the other potential symptoms. So, like, you want to do medical workups to rule out things like tumors or crazy blood chemistry or some kind of extreme allergies. But you also want to rule out things like psychotic depression or schizophrenia, because some of those things from time to time sort of kind of look like aspects of DID. And MMPI is a good, is kind of a useful tool in that regard, and obviously a very good clinical history with background, and you're looking for trauma, early trauma in particular, in the person's life. But ultimately, I have seen one of these, and it was a female, and the only one I've ever seen personally. I've seen videos, but the only one I've ever actually seen, and it was so obvious it wasn't even funny. And it's just, they just don't, their energy, if you will, and I know that's not very clinical, I don't mean to sound all but the energy and their interpersonal dynamics are really, really different. And this woman, literally, within like the 2-hour intake interview, literally shifted like 3 or 4 times in the 2 hours. And it was, I'd start to get a topic, and I'd talk about a topic, and you could see the anxiety. I mean, you could see the look in the eyes and the body language, and all of a sudden, it was like you were with a different person. I mean, it was really, it was a little frightening, actually, in the sense that I wasn't scared for me, but it was just like, holy moly, the voice changed completely. I mean, I could see where if somebody saw that, they'd go, oh my God, this woman's possessed. You know, it really was kind of like that, right? It's almost like when you see these horror movies with these, you know, demonic possessions or these altered spirits coming in and, you know, the red rum, Mrs. Sorens, you know. it was really that dramatic. It was like, holy moly. And then, of course, you want to rule out other things to make sure, but it's, when you see it, it is undeniable. And you won't see it, like I said, I've been doing work of one kind or another since 1983, and I've seen one of these, and that was in the mid-90s. And I've never seen another one.
Interesting.
Uh-huh. And so you get a history, you get a good family history, you get a good personal history, you rule out a bunch of things, as I said, like schizophrenia or other dissociative disorders or borderline personality disorder, or psychotic depression or substance, in the throes of a substance withdrawal or addiction or whatever, and run a bunch of lab tests, medical tests, to make sure that we don't have some kind of medication side effect or head trauma, since you've got, organic brain damage kind of stuff or brain alterations. And, and once you do all that, then, it's kind of like what you got left is DID. There's no other explanation unless you want to bring a witch doctor in, and go, the spirits are about to speak. So that's kind of how you do it. And it's, I've only seen one, so I'm certainly in no way, shape, or form a DID expert by any means.
All right. What I'm thinking of doing is, since we haven't really started on the diagnosis stuff except for your commentary, I think we may go ahead and pause right here. I do have some notes.
We need to talk about treatment too.
Yeah, exactly. So there are some notes in here about some ways to, you know, certain tests that people suggest and stuff, but that's going to extend the discussion into another 15 minutes, I think. So we'll go ahead and we'll pause here, and then we'll do part two for our next show, and you guys can find out some more about diagnosis and treatment and, you know, myths and misconceptions about the whole thing. We can talk about all that kind of fun stuff in 2 weeks.
Absolutely.
If that's okay.
Absolutely. So absolutely. Good idea.
I'll put a little marker in the script, and then we will come back to this in a couple of weeks. I'm going to do something colorful so I can see it. There we go. Perfect. All righty. So in that case, let's go down to the end, and I'm going to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there's any other general commentary that you want to make that we didn't get to before we wrap this up for the evening.
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay, perfect. So in summary, we haven't covered everything yet, but we hope that at least this is a start to better understanding dissociative identity disorder. It's not as common of a pathology as many others, which our listeners could be potentially have to deal, but hopefully we've disabused you guys of stereotypes and misinformation, and we're going to get into that in much heavier detail next time and prepare you guys in case you have to address this for yourselves or a loved one. So this will conclude our show on dissociative identity disorder, part one. And on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and give our appreciation to those of you who may be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. So we'll see you guys in 2 weeks with a new topic for discussion, which will be DID Part 2. And that'll be Wednesday, September 2nd, 11 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on blogtalkradio.com. We'd also like to give a shout-out to other NDB Media shows that are coming up in the next couple of weeks. So Travel Itch Radio tomorrow night, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Although Travel Itch Radio rarely promotes a particular product, Nasal Guard is a notable exception. An airborne particle blocker that is non-invasive, drug-free, and easy to use, Nasal Guard protects against allergies and airborne contaminants, both indoor and outdoor. Inventor Kanika Wahi, an engineer working in concert with her father, Ashok, hope I said that right, explains more when she visits the show. Dan Schlossberg and Mary Ellen Nugent-Lee conduct a live interview in the 380th episode of Travel Itch Radio. On Saturday, Sports Talk with the Guys, Saturday morning extravaganza, 9 a.m. Eastern Time. The Monday morning quarterbacks are live on Saturday morning. No one is safe while they troll the digital airwaves, so join them as they discuss the latest news in the world of sports and review events of the past week. No fantasy sports there. They keep it real. Next, update on the Walking Dead online viewing party. Season 10, Episode 16, A Certain Doom, will air on October 4th, and Season 10 has been extended by 6 episodes. No, I don't know exactly how that's going to work yet, and I'll let you guys know when I find out. The new third Walking Dead series, World Beyond, will also premiere the same night, October 4th. Fear the Walking Dead Season 6 will air the following weekend, October 11th, 2020. And I assume that these mysterious 6 extended episodes are going to be, you know, Sunday nights like it used to be. I don't even know that yet. More details to come as we get closer. Monday Night in America with Roger Noriega, that'll be August 24th, 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Roger Noriega brings you his unique take on politics, current events, entertainment, sci-fi, and history. The following Tuesday, the 25th, Fandom Access Week in Review. Join the chatty critics Jamie, Karen, and AJ as they digest another night of TV. And last but not least, certainly, Jedi Tax Radio. And that'll be first Sunday of the month. That'll be September 6th. A new show airing monthly on first Sundays, Rogelio D. Noriega, CRTP, with 33 years of income tax preparation experience, discussing the latest news in income taxes, ongoing issues for taxpayers and tax preparers. If you have a question that you need answered, contact him on Twitter at the IRS Man. Special guests and co-hosts will join him. See also Jedi.tax and his Twitter account, and bring questions to the show for Sundays. Be a good time to ask people about the second stimulus check coming up, because that's going to be a big tax pain in the ass for a lot of people. So that's a good place to go clean that up. All right. Please look for us on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and at www.rockandrollshrink.com. Good night, everybody. We appreciate you joining us. See you next time, and rock on.